Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, "Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another." Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, "We are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with, and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better." It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, Lake City, Florida, and the rest of humanity living on the planet Earth who are listening via live streaming at IronSharpensIronRadio.com. This is Chris Arnson, your host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, wishing you all a happy Wednesday on this third day of January 2018, the third day of 2018 as well. And I am excited about my interview today. I have a first-time guest today. His name is Brian Gadawa, and he is a professional writer, award-winning screenwriter, including his first feature film, To End All Wars, starring Kiefer Sutherland. You may recognize that name. He is not only a renowned actor in his own right, but his father is Donald Sutherland, also a very renowned actor. And Brian is a director of feature films, documentaries, and video promotionals. He is an international speaker on art, movies, worldviews, and faith, and author of the Chronicles series of novels, which are his most important contribution by incarnating his worldview and theology in narrative, unlike anything you've read before. Today we are addressing his latest book, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast. And just to give you a little blurb to whet your appetite about this book, Gary DeMar of American Vision says, "If you're looking for some great history with compelling storytelling, you need to read Tyrant. You'll also learn the role of this beast of a ruler plays in God's prophetic timetable." And as I said, that was Gary DeMar. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, Brian Gadawa.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here. Got a lot of cool stuff to talk about.
Great. And if anybody wants to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com. chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And please give us your first name, at least, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. Only remain anonymous if you're asking about a personal and private matter. Perhaps your eschatology is different than your own pastor's, or perhaps you're a pastor who has different eschatology than your own denomination, or something like that. I can understand you're wanting to remain anonymous. But other than that, please give us at least your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. Well, Brian, what I usually do with first-time guests is I usually have them tell us something about the religious upbringing of their childhood, if any, and how our sovereign Lord drew you to himself, what providential circumstances arose in your life that the Lord used to draw you to himself, awaken you to the truth, and caused you to embrace Jesus Christ, his word, and his gospel.
Well, good question, yeah. I was in high school many, many decades ago. I don't want to reveal my age, because I'm in Hollywood. But many, many years ago, when I was in high school, I was raised in a Roman Catholic home, and while I do certainly believe there are true believers in the Catholic Church, my family was not particularly, and my parents were not, but we just went through the rituals, and we went through, we went to church and all that kind of stuff. But so I kind of had that background in ritualized religion and such, and I had a strong antipathy towards it because I'm also an artist, always been an artist, have that artistic mentality. I think a lot about death, not in a suicidal sense, but really more in a sense of it's the one thing that has always really caused me to evaluate my life, make sure I'm doing the most I can with my life, because life is very short and I want meaning and purpose. And so as an artist, I always strove for that meaning and purpose. And but I, fortunately, my parents allowed me to go and visit this youth group out in Chicago many, many decades ago called Sun City. And it was actually the original ministry of Willow Creek Community Church. And through my experience with that, I was introduced to the gospel in a very simple sense. And, you know, they did a lot of teen games, and they had drama, and they played rock music, which was something that I didn't get in the context of my other church experience. And so it made Christianity relevant to my own world as a young teen, you know. So I basically learned the basic story of the gospel, and I had no big emotional, transformation or anything. It made sense, and it seemed like the truth. And I realized that, even though I was a good person, actually, I was never really a bad kid. I never did drugs. I didn't even smoke. You know, I just didn't care to, and didn't drink, didn't have sex and all that kind of stuff in school. But I realized that I was full of pride, you know. And so the way that God kind of drew me was I thought of this desire to have purpose and meaning. And I thought, man, you know, I want to have a life that leaves a legacy. I wanted to be like Michelangelo. But I started realizing, you know, when I'm dead, wherever I went, wherever I would be, it certainly wouldn't be of any help to me. And it doesn't matter how famous I may have been, I would have no connection to that, whatever was going on in that world, you know. Just like Michelangelo doesn't care how highly we value his art now. It doesn't matter to him wherever he is, that kind of a thing. And so it made me realize that I'd be dead a whole lot longer than I was alive. Just basic truths, you know, that made me sort of go, well, you know, I really need to consider what's going to happen to me when I'm gone. And, you know, I had been introduced to the basic notions of that, you know, I was a sinner and I was a person who violated God's law. And like I said, even though I didn't do anything bad, I knew I was bad inside, because I knew I had broken all of God's laws, at least in my heart. You know, Jesus said, if you even lust after a woman, you've committed adultery, right? So, in your heart. And so, I realized that truth, that I was as black of heart as any other wicked person, and I needed forgiveness just as well. And so, I put my faith in Jesus Christ, what he did on the cross for me, and just basically prayed a basic prayer. Like I said, nothing big dramatic happened to me, but from that time on, I started seeing my own life differently. I started seeing even the little things that I did were important to God, and the little sins, whether it's a lie here or, you know, watching an inappropriate movie there or whatever, you know, it started to concern me. I started realizing that my life was changing from the inside out. God's Holy Spirit had actually, I soon learned, you know, theologically, God's Holy Spirit had come into my life. And that began my journey in high school, and my personal journey has been heavily influenced by Christian apologetics. For some reason, I just hunger to know answers to questions. I hunger to know truth. I hunger to know what is real, what is true, that kind of a thing. And so I was driven heavily by Christian apologetics for a lot of my life. That's how I learned a lot about doctrine. And eventually, you know, I went through a sort of a typical evangelical experience, Billy Graham sort of campus crusade Christian, and later on in my life, in after my college years, and actually I got married. After I got married, I started to read. Well, let's put it this way: I pursued all kinds of theological understandings, and I ended up becoming reformed in my faith, and that from then on. You know, there's a lot more that happens after that, but that was sort of a big transforming part of time in my life, because that was when I feel that I began to understand a little bit God's sovereignty, which is more than just this sort of like, yeah, he's king over all and he's accomplishing his will. It's like, no, I mean, he drew me to himself, and my salvation does not rest in me. You know, he even gave me my own faith, and that was a transformation for me that really took my my self-reliance, it ripped self-reliance out of my soul, and I cast my you know, heart at the feet of Christ's sovereignty, and I don't count that as my true redemption. I believe I was redeemed when I believed in Christ, you know, but I guess what I'm saying is, you know, we all have journeys where we grow and learn things and shed them, and that was what happened to me.
Amen. And I'm sure, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm sure that you would agree that even though from an outsider's point of view, nothing dramatic or radically transformational occurred in your life, spiritually it did. I mean, obviously there was, you came from death to life. That's a pretty remarkably dramatic and radical transformation there. But I understand what you mean by in the way that someone might view you. Like, for instance, there are many children who are raised by ministers, for example, or in Christian homes, and they have been preserved from overtly scandalous and rebellious behavior for their whole lives, and they at one point realized they needed a savior, even though by the standards of men on earth, they were good people, quote quote. But I'm sure that's what you would view in regard to your own conversion or salvation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, I think that you know, the wickedness in our hearts, you know, it's original sin. It's the, you know, the sinful nature that is in all of us. If you know, it can be fed or it can be anorexic, you know, you can feed it or not. And so we are all capable of doing heinous evil. It's just a matter of, are we going to feed it? Are we going to pursue it or not? So I don't consider myself above, you know, a serial killer or a rapist or the most wicked things we can think of. I see that same evil is in all of our hearts. And so we need Christ to cleanse us daily. And, you know, it's not that you can overnight just turn around and murder someone, but we can definitely feed that sinful nature, and it's a process, and it's not this like, oh, well, I'm not bad, but those people over there, really, they deserve hell. It's like, no, when you really come to understand the nature of God's holiness, you really see how depraved you are and how you need his grace every single day.
Yes, in fact, I believe that if God and his sovereignty were not restraining the evil hearts of men, not only would it be totally unsafe to leave your home, it'd be totally unsafe even to stay in your home. You wouldn't be safe anywhere.
Exactly.
And the fact that we are not all serial killers and rapists is because of that fact, that God is restraining evil men. Well, could you give us some of your heroes of the Reformed faith that led you in that direction?
Well, very good question. You know, I read a little bit of Calvin in the beginning, but to be honest, I was introduced to a lot of it through apologetics, and I discovered a man named Greg Bahnsen, and of course he's passed away since then. And,
yes.
And he was actually a kind of a lightning rod as well for some controversial things, but I tell you, he was the most brilliant apologist I had ever heard that transformed my understanding of the nature of our faith and how it's more, you know, I'm more Augustinian in the sense that, you know, I used to believe that if I could just win the arguments and prove to someone the reliability of the Bible and you know, Christ's resurrection, then they'll have to believe. But, I've come to realize that, no, you can do all that and they'll, and someone could even raise from the dead, of course, and they'll still not believe because their heart is not regenerate. And so we do our best to, trust in God, communicate the gospel, defend it, but realize that God is the one doing the work in their hearts. And Bahnsen sort of changed my viewpoint on that, and that led me into the Reformed faith as well. And then I read a little bit of Cornelius Van Til, but I still felt that Bahnsen was better at actually describing that viewpoint than Van Til was himself, you know. And, then through him, I discovered some other guys like Ken Gentry and Gary DeMar. And these guys are not, they're not the theologians of the past, but I read more of the contemporary guys. And then those were the ones that I then started discovering a different way of understanding eschatology, you know. And I had been typically brought up because, you know, I was into Hal Lindsey, you know, because we're talking like the 70s, late 70s, I became a Christian. And so Hal Lindsey was really super big at that time. And of course, his late great Planet Earth sold, gosh, I don't know, like 30 million copies by all by itself. I mean, he was the hugest phenomenon. In fact, in some ways, he was even more influential than Left Behind is today, because his single book sold 30 million and Left Behind sold 60, but that was like 12 books, right? And that's at a much later date. So I was heavily influenced by that, expecting that the, you know, Lord could or the rapture could happen at any moment, and there's going to be a 7-year tribulation with the Antichrist. And so I, you know, I lived a faith that was sort of, you know, I would go out and, you know, talk to people about that and say, "You ready to meet God? Be, you know, and judge me, because, you know, the Antichrist is going to come, and, you know, Christians are going to be left off the earth." And of course, at that time in the 70s, it was not well known. That whole theory was known in the Christian world, but not in the secular world. You know, it was still something they weren't familiar with. But by now, of course, even the secular world is very familiar with that whole scenario, because it's been pumped out and has made a gazillion dollars, and that's how people have gotten to know it. Well, that's what I believed at the time. So when I started reading DeMar and Gentry, who are also Reformed, and in that same school of thinking, and it started to open my mind, because at first what they were saying, I reacted against it as if it was like heresy. As a matter of fact, I thought it was heresy. I, you know, I considered it heresy, but that was only because I was never taught that there are multiple different views within the Orthodox body of Christ through history, right? Amillennialism, premillennialism, and postmillennialism, they're all legitimate views because godly, scholarly men have held them. But it was just very common in that world of dispensationalism that I was raised in, that believed in this sort of picture of, you know, the 7-year tribulation and Antichrist and all that kind of stuff, that was in our future at the time, that the rapture could happen at any moment. It was really common for them to say, this is the basic Bible view, and all of the views, they ignored all of the views, right? And so when I started reading it, it was shocking to me, but it was very fascinating, because they addressed this historical time period that is very crucial to both Judaism and Christianity that nobody was teaching on. And that was the time period from the end of the book of Acts to the destruction of the temple in AD 70. So from, like, they say, 40 or 50 AD to 70 AD, this generation, where this massive Jewish revolt occurred. The Roman armies came under Titus, destroyed the temple, and destroyed Jerusalem. And, of course, the temple hasn't been built since, right? And this event, they went into the historical aspect of it because they were trying to argue, that it was fulfillment of biblical prophecy, like in the book of Revelation. And that was the thing that drew me to say, wow, this is fascinating history, even if I don't agree with it. But then over time, as I read it, I became persuaded by their arguments.
Yes, and I have had the privilege of interviewing at least three of the names that I remember you mentioning. First of all, I had the great honor of interviewing years ago, before I had my own radio show, I had the pleasure and privilege of interviewing Greg Bahnsen in the study of Steve Schlissel, pastor of Messiah's Congregation in Brooklyn. And Steve and I have been friends for many years, although I am in stark contrast or in very strong disagreement with him over Federal Vision. But we have had a friendship for many years, and back then Steve was not a Federal Visionist, because I don't even think they existed back then when I had the privilege of visiting Messiah's Congregation when Greg Bahnsen was preaching there. And he preached on the ascension of Christ, something that I very rarely have ever heard preached on.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, Steve gave me the privilege of going into his study and interviewing him on an old-fashioned portable cassette recorder, because that's all they had back then. And tragically, I lost the cassette. So I hope that one day it somehow miraculously turns up. But I also interviewed Ken Gentry and Gary DeMar, and I may have forgotten some of the other names that you mentioned that I have also interviewed. But it's been a very rich life that I have had the honor of having to interview such great guys. And in fact, we just interviewed Gary not long ago on Iron Trip and Zion Radio. But
yep, I heard it.
Oh, you did. Oh, great.
Yeah, I did.
And we have a listener question already, and I think it would be wise to ask it now because it kind of helps set the stage for the rest of the interview. Dear brothers Chris and Brian, is the Chronicles of the Apocalypse, I guess that should have been written, are the Chronicles of the Apocalypse, the partial preterist views answer to Tim LaHaye's Left Behind series? And then he says, laugh loudly, Chris, that's meant to be a joke. But actually, I think it's a very good question, whether or not he meant it to be a joke. Is this a partial preterist answer to Tim LaHaye's Left Behind series?
Well, you know, the short answer is yes, it is. But I would like to qualify that by saying, I do not like likening it to Left Behind as if it's derivative, you know, like, oh, I'm just going to try to make money off, or I'm going to try to rip them off and do my version with my, you know, because that's not at all the basis or the foundation of me writing the novels. You know, I wanted to make that important. But in truth, what it does end up becoming is, yeah, it's basically a partial preterist Left Behind, so to speak. And sometimes I do an advertisement for the series and I say, this is not your mother's Left Behind.
That could be taken in many wrong ways.
Yeah, that's true. But the origin of that was, I have to say, is from that old commercial, "Not Your Father's Cadillac."
You know? Right. Well, that also those are fighting words, actually.
Yeah. But you know, this is where we come into that unique crossroads. In that, what I have is a very unique approach to this very world of eschatology, because how can I put it? I've written a lot on this myself in other books, but sadly, I think Reformed and even more and other traditional Christian, viewpoints are sadly lacking in appreciation for the arts and for imagination. You know, sometimes we tend to over. Are you still there?
Yeah, that was just the computer making weird noises.
So we have the tendency to sort of over-intellectualize and over-elevate the, you know, the scholarship and such, which is, of course, all good stuff. I read that stuff. I'm drawn to it myself. But we tend to downplay the creative side of our faith and the creative side of the Bible, too. And so I'm kind of this unique person where I've got this love of theology and philosophy, but I'm also an artist. And so what happened is, you know, I've been screenwriting in Hollywood for many years, and, you know, I made a few movies. The only correction I have to make to your description of me is I've only directed documentaries, but I have not directed feature films. I've only written feature films, but I haven't directed them. But whatever, that's neither here nor there. But so I've been writing.
Did I say that in your introduction?
Yeah, that's okay.
I thought that I was reading right off of your website.
Well, I'll double-check that, make sure I didn't say features. I mean, I've written features, but I haven't directed them, because features are more like, you know, the movies you see at the theaters.
Right.
Documentaries are more like the things on PBS or whatever. So,
right.
But anyway, so, you know, so I have this background. I love storytelling, and I'm a professional storyteller and an expert at it. But, you know, years ago, about 7 years ago now, I kind of had a couple tough years in Hollywood, and I realized I needed to do more than just trying to do screenplays, because it wasn't paying the bills enough. And that's where I finally launched out in writing novels. And that's what opened the door for me, where now I am both a novelist and a Hollywood screenwriter, but my novels are, what I wrote was I wrote stories that I wanted to read myself, or that, you know, I study all this stuff, and a lot of times it's arcane to a lot of normal Christians. And I can't talk to it. They don't care to hear about it. But I just I love it. And so I realized that, hey, I could put this stuff into story form that could make it more understandable and more enjoyable. And I could basically write theological novels that would be entertaining for people, and they would learn theology, so to speak, through the narrative, through storytelling itself. Maybe a kind of a narrative theology, you could call it. And I think that that's my unique contribution, I think, to the body, that because I bring both of those sides to the page. And so even though I had studied, I'd studied for a decade, this was like 20 years ago. I met Gary DeMar and Ken Gentry and got into their work, and I studied it for years, but I couldn't hardly tell it to anybody because most people it was so bizarre, So I put it aside. I pursued more of my other creative stuff. And in recent years, it suddenly struck me as I was writing my novels that I had written all these novels called Chronicles of the Nephilim, and I won't go into too much detail, but just to say that was sort of a creative exploration of the sort of supernatural side of the Bible that I had tended to disregard through a lot of my faith. And as I sort of rediscovered this aspect of it and a storyline to the Bible that I hadn't seen before, I wanted to retell these fantastic warrior stories, Joshua, Abraham, David, but tell the stuff that hasn't been told before while being consistent with the Bible. So I get a little bit into the giants, like the giants in the land of Canaan, and that's not just this weird, arbitrary thing in the Bible. There's actually a storyline that connects a lot of giants. A lot of people, Christians, don't even realize that there was, in the Bible, it says that there were literally five giants who were hunting down King David. And what? That's in the Bible? Yes, it is. So I try to tell those stories that we don't know a lot about, and I fictionalize them, but I try to make it consistent with the Bible. And I ended the series with Jesus triumphant. So it starts with Noah Primeval. I start with a flood, and there's eight novels and ends with Jesus triumphant. And, of course, I end with the ascension. And then I suddenly realized, I thought I was done with the series, and then I realized, wait a minute. I've studied this partial preterist eschatology for years, and the end of this story is not the ministry of Christ. I've realized the most supernatural book in the New Testament is of course Revelation, and since I believe that was all, that was basically focused on the fall of Jerusalem, and that I believe that it was the culmination of Messiah's, victory over the powers, the principalities and powers, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm not done yet. And that's what launched me on Chronicles of the Apocalypse, which is this new series. And even though you can read it apart from Chronicles of the Nephilim, definitely, but it is also rooted in the same sort of storyline. And that's what I realized. I looked around and I thought, hey, wait a minute, no partial preterists have ever written a novel series on it. And I did discover, wait, there was one, Hank Hanegraaff, and he wrote that about a decade ago. I think it was called The Last Disciple series. But it never took off, and it never, it just wasn't a good seller. So I think most people don't even know about it, So maybe there's only one other guy who did this, and I thought, we really need this, because I think it's still a controversial view, partial preterism, because the dominant view is still, a futurist sort of scenario, and quite frankly, the loudest voices are dispensationalists. We could talk about what those are, I guess, but the loudest view is really anti-preterist. And so I thought, well, we've got some guys out there like Gary and Ken and many more now who are making the theological arguments, and they're far better theologians than I am. I'm more of an artist. But I realized, but maybe we can connect with people. Maybe our viewpoint can connect with people in a dramatic narrative way, in a way that theology can't, because there's a lot of Christians who don't want to get into all that in-depth theology, right? And so that's what sort of inspired me to write the story of Chronicles of the Apocalypse, where I'm incarnating this view, and the goal is to tell the story from A.D. 64 to A.D. 70, this time period that was the Jewish revolt and the fall of Jerusalem, and to show how, I believe John wrote Revelation. There's controversy, but basically I believe he wrote it around AD 65 in the midst of the persecution, the Neronic persecution. So I start in AD 64 with the Great Fire of Rome, and then what I want to do is I want to show how in the context of the ancient first century, while John's writing the book of Revelation, how they would understand that language as being applied to them.
Yeah.
By just simply acting that out, it helps people understand it in a way that, theology doesn't.
Right. We have to go to our first break right now, and when we come back, we will have to have you define partial preterism, and preterism for that matter. because a lot of our listeners may be scratching their heads wondering what that means. By the way, I have to hook you up or introduce you to Pastor Doug Van Dorn of the Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado, who has written on the Nephilim, and he is possibly of a different eschatological persuasion than you are, but you still might get to enjoy developing a friendship with him because of the fact that he has a published work on that subject and many others, very few people seem to be writing on that. Of course, I know that yours is a work of fiction and his is a work of theology and church history and history itself.
Yeah.
Old Covenant history, Old Testament history. But but I would love to have you exchange contact information.
There's no need, Chris. We're already good friends.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's great. Praise God. And so we're going to be going to our first break right now. If anybody wants to join us, and by the way, Joe in Slovenia, who asked our first question, he has a second question that we will get to when we return from the break. So be patient, Joe in Slovenia. And if anybody else wants to join us, our email address is chrisarnzen@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. And remember, always give your first name, your city and state, and your country of residence if you live outside the USA. Please only remain anonymous if your question involves a personal and private matter. Don't go away. God willing, we'll be right back with Brian Gadawa.
Hi, I'm Chris Arnzen, host of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, here to tell you about an exciting offer from World Magazine, my trusted source for news from a Christian perspective. Try World at no charge for 90 days and get a free copy of R.C. Sproul's book, Relationship Between Church and State. I rely on World because I trust the reporting. I gain insight from the analysis, and World provides clarity to the news stories that really matter. I believe you'll also find World to be an invaluable resource to better understand critical topics with a depth that's simply not found in other media outlets. Armed with this coverage, World can help you to be a voice of wisdom in your family and your community. This trial includes bi-weekly issues of World Magazine, on-scene reporting from World Radio, and the fully shareable content of World Digital. Simply visit wmg.org/ironsharpens to get your World trial and Dr. Sproul's book all free. No obligation with no credit card required. Visit World News Group at wng.org/ironsharpens today.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
One sure way all Iron Sharpens Iron Radio listeners can help keep my show on the air is to support my advertisers. I know you all use batteries every day, so I'm urging you all from now on to exclusively use BatteryDepot.com for all your battery needs. At BatteryDepot.com, they're changing the status quo. They're flipping the script. They're sticking it to the man. In other words, they'd like to change the battery industry for good by providing an extensive inventory of top-of-the-line batteries that are uniformly new, dependable, and affordable.
Ordering from BatteryDepot.com ensures you'll always get fresh out-of-the-box batteries you can count on to work properly at competitive prices. Whether you need batteries for cordless phones, cell phones, radios, PCs, laptops, tablets, baby monitors, hearing aids, smoke detectors, credit card readers, digital cameras, electronic cigarettes, GPSs, MP3 players, watches, or nearly anything else you own that needs batteries, go to BatteryDepot.com. Next day shipping available. All products protected by 30-day guarantees and 6-month warranties. Call 866-403-3768. That's 866-403-3768. Or go to BatteryDepot.com. That's BatteryDepot.com.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor.
Hi, I'm Buzz Taylor, frequent co-host with Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. I would like to introduce you to my good friends Todd and Patty Jennings at CVBBS, which stands for Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service. Todd and Patty specialize in supplying Reformed and Puritan books and Bibles at discount prices that make them affordable to everyone. Since 1987, the family-owned and operated book service has sought to bring you the best available Christian books and Bibles at the best possible prices. Unlike other book sites, they make no effort to provide every book that is available because, frankly, much of what is being printed is not worth your time. That means you can get to the good stuff faster. It also means that you don't have to worry about being assaulted by the pornographic, heretical, and otherwise faith-insulting material promoted by the secular book vendors. Their website is cvbbs.com. Browse the pages at ease, shop at your leisure, and purchase with confidence as Todd and Patty work in service to you, the church, and to Christ. That's Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service at cvbbs.com. That's cvbbs.com. Let Todd and Patty know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
And you can call cvbbs.com at their toll-free number as well, 800-656-0231, 800-656-0231. That phone line is typically manned between 10 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday, and they have a wonderful offer that they are conducting right now. If you purchase a minimum of $50 worth of merchandise from cvbbs.com, you will receive absolutely free of charge a book that retails for $15, Knowing and Growing in Assurance of Faith by Dr. Joel Beakey. Joel Beakey is one of the greatest minds of Reformed theology alive today, and I'm sure you will love this book on assurance of faith, if indeed you are a lover of the Reformed faith. So you'll get that absolutely free of charge. As I said, it retails for $15. If you purchase $50 or more worth of merchandise at cvbbs.com, that book is yours absolutely free of charge. Please, please, please remember to tell cvbbs.com that you heard about them from Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, and you could do so either by calling them at that toll-free number I mentioned, or you can do so when you place your order. You click on the option for instructions. After you place your order, click on instructions, and then you could type in there that you heard about them from Chris Arnson on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. And now we are back to our guest, Brian Gadawa. He is a novelist, and he has written a book that we are discussing today that is a part of a series of books. This specific book is titled Tyrant, Rise of the Beast. If you'd like to join us on the air with a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. And before we go to the second part of Joe in Slovenia's question, I want you to define both preterism and partial preterism, because sometimes partial preterists don't use the word partial in their description of themselves, and that could be dangerous because people may lump them together with those who would just merely describe themselves as preterists, who we would call hyper-preterists, whom we would think are dangerously delving into some heretical waters, who do not believe in the physical, visible future return of Jesus Christ, and they also reject a future resurrection of the dead for both those who are saved and those who are lost. So we have to make sure that we are clear when we describe ourselves or others with these labels. So if you could, let us know something about preterism and partial preterism.
Sure. Before I define that, I'll just quickly define that, you know, futurism, which is the dominant belief in eschatology, also has a wide berth of different varieties, but it basically is the notion that the prophecies of the last days are in our future. And so preterism comes from the Latin word preteris, which means prior or beforehand. So preterism is the belief that last days prophecies happened in our past. So the difference between, and there are varieties. Some believe they're all fulfilled. Some believe that most all of them are fulfilled. So those who believe that all the last days prophecies occurred in the past would be full preterists, and partial preterists believe most of them are, with yet, I would say, the three striking differences is there's still a return of Christ, a resurrection, and a judgment. But it's important to understand that the notion of last days is very important, because when we hear that word, we impose on it our own cultural assumptions. And what I discovered studying the New Testament and the Old Testament was, if you study the phrase last days or the end of the age or the end of the ages, you'll actually discover explicitly in the text of the New Testament that the last days are not the last days of the earth, as futurists believe, but the last days of the Old Covenant, as preterists tend to believe. So when you see that phrase, last days and end of age, that people are shocked. How can you say it happened in the past? Because it's obviously the last days of the earth. No, last days is a phrase in the ancient Jewish economy and religion that basically meant the last days of the Old Covenant, which means that preterism and partial, let me back up here. So futurism would believe that there is, in our future, there's going to be a rapture of the Christians, 7-year tribulation, an antichrist that rises up to save the world and makes a covenant with Israel and then turns his back on them and puts a statue of himself in the temple or something like that, and then he seeks to kill all the Jews, and then there's Armageddon where all the nations come descend upon Israel for this big battle. And that's the scenario that's going to happen in our future. Whereas preterists, even though we believe that there is still a future resurrection, judgment, and second coming of Christ, it's not tied to that, because all that stuff, the tribulation, the antichrist, what do you want to call him, the beast, that has happened in the past. That's the shocking controversy that Christians are not used to dealing with. But there's very strong scriptural basis for that belief, and we can go through some of those details. But essentially, those are the two big differences. And so the purpose then of Revelation in the futurist scenario is to tell the end of the earth and the second coming of Christ and the final judgment of mankind. But that's what a futurist believes. But a preterist believes, no, actually it's not about that. It's about the coming judgment on Jerusalem, and it's described in very cataclysmic, hyperbolic terms. But basically the purpose of Revelation in the preterist system is that John is telling, it's written before the temple is destroyed, probably around AD 65, right? Jesus had predicted, he said, you know, look out for these things, because within one generation, I'm going to not leave one stone upon itself in this temple, right? And so he's saying, in Matthew 23, Jesus says to the Jews around him, he talks about this long history of how you killed the, your ancestors killed the prophets, and now you're going to reject Messiah and kill him. So all the blood guilt of all the prophets are going to be on you. Why? Because you're going to kill Messiah himself, see? So Jesus pronounces a judgment on the generation of Jews that rejected him as Messiah. And so, and that hadn't happened yet. So John is now telling that picture that Jesus described in Matthew 24. John is telling, here's what's going to happen in our near future, because two things. Rather than the revelation being about the end of the earth and the second coming, it's actually about the end of the old covenant and God's judgment on the Jews, the first century Jews particularly, for rejecting Christ. And you know, you can find that in the very beginning of the book of Revelation, where John actually literally says, in the very first chapter, you know, he says, the time is near, it's going to soon take place. What? Chapter 1, verse 7, he says, behold, he's coming on the clouds, every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will wail on account of him. And it's really, really fascinating, because there's a lot of these kinds of verses in Revelation that have been poorly translated and poorly interpreted by Christians to make them assume it's the end of the earth. The phrase there, all the tribes of the earth will wail. Well, what does that mean? Is that all the earth? Well, no. The word for earth is actually ge, which is Greek, and it most often means land or a localized plot of earth, not the globe as we understand it. And so it's really better translated all the tribes of the land. But don't take my word for it, or don't take Greek lexicon's word for it. Look at the verse that he's actually quoting from, which is in Zechariah. Zechariah 12, 10 through 12, talks about him pouring out in the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace, which is, of course, the gospel. So that when they look on me, whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him as one mourns for a child. And on that day, the mourning in Jerusalem will be as great as, and he goes on to say that all the families of the houses of Israel. So he's clearly, Zechariah is clearly saying it's about the tribes of the land of Israel. So if you go back through Revelation and you reread those words, wherever it says earth and makes you assume it's the globe, retranslate it as land, and realize that the ancient Jews, when they said the land, they most often thought the land of Israel. Now you can start to see how Revelation is really more about a judgment, not on the earth, but on the land of Israel. And why? Because they killed Messiah. They rejected Messiah. And God says, I'm going to destroy the city. Jesus gave parables. I'm going to go and come and destroy the city because you rejected him, and the cornerstone will become the cornerstone of the building, right, of the new temple of God. And then he said, and then secondly, this is very, very crucial to understanding what's going on, and that is that the destruction of the temple was a crucial historical verification of the spiritual truth of the new covenant. What I mean is, God is not a God of abstraction. He's not just a God of philosophy. He doesn't just say, Jesus died, and trust me, he died and went to heaven, he died for your sins, and the new covenant's in, and the old covenant's gone. Because all the Jews, imagine all the Jews being told that, and they're looking, they're saying, but the temple's still here. So how can it possibly be if the temple, which is the embodiment and incarnation of the old Mosaic covenant, it's still on earth, how can you say that it's not valid? And so the way that God verifies or validates historically what he does spiritually, God is a God of history. So within a generation of the cross and ascension, cross, resurrection, and ascension, right? Within that generation, like Jesus said, this generation will see these things, right? By the year AD 70, God destroys the temple and the holy city because he's destroying historically the historical and physical embodiment of the old covenant, which is interesting that the temple has never been able to be rebuilt in history. I don't find that a coincidence. I think it's God saying, I'm never going to let that happen again because the new covenant is here, and he destroys that old covenant symbol in order to validate the new covenant. So it's sort of like, this is where you get this now and the not yet, right? Christ does spiritually, he dies for our sins, he ascends to heaven, seated on the throne of God in the heavenlies, and the new covenant has arrived. It's been inaugurated but not yet fully consummated until the old system has been completely wiped out. And that's what the book of Hebrews talks about, right? So this is the different worldview, the different picture of approaching Revelation that preterists have. It's really not that once you start to study the language of Revelation and see how it's connected to the Old Testament and not to our future, it's really not that shocking or controversial to see that Revelation is about the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70 for this final culmination of the new covenant and God's marriage. Or let's put it this way. God divorces the harlot of apostate Israel who rejected him, right? He divorces the harlot, executes her, so to speak, and marries the new bride, the bride of Christ, which is the new Jerusalem. And that's the new covenant. So it's really a picture that makes sense when you start to interpret it through their eyes, not through our modern Western post-scientific eyes.
And one thing, though, that I want you to make clear, because you told me, you informed me before the program, that you do believe in a physical future return of Christ. You do believe in a future bodily resurrection of the saved and the lost, that you are not what has been called a hyper-preterist or a full preterist, etc.
Correct. I am not. I believe there are passages like 1 Corinthians 15 that do clearly talk about Christ coming. So what I believe the picture is that much of what Christians think is about the second coming isn't about the second coming. It's about a judgment coming of Christ. So in other words, there are fine distinctions within their context that we don't understand within our context. So when in Matthew 24, when Jesus says that, you know, and this is the classic, you know, passage that makes it so hard for people to see, doesn't it clearly say that in Matthew 24, verse 30, then will appear the sign of the Son of Man, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Oh, there it is again, the tribes of the land will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. This is the phrase that trips up so many Christians, because on the surface, we look at that and assume it's got to be the second coming. But I would argue it does not, because that imagery is rooted in poetic language that is very prominent in the Old Testament. And I can, you know, give you a couple of examples of that in a second. But my main point is just because I believe that Christ coming in judgment, coming in the clouds of heaven in judgment, is a coming, but it's not the second coming. It's a spiritual coming. And the reason why I say that is because you look back in the Old Testament, and there's many examples that describe whenever God visits judgment upon a tribe, a city, or a people, he describes it as coming on the clouds of judgment. And so, for example, and by the way, this is not just against Israel, it's against any nation. Like when he destroyed the first temple in Israel using Babylon, whenever God uses pagan nations to judge another nation, he describes it as coming on the clouds. So in Jeremiah 4, we read, "Behold, Yahweh comes like the clouds, his chariot the whirlwind. Warn the nations he is coming. Besiegers come from a distant land. They shout against the cities of Judah." So he equates God coming with the coming of pagan nations. So God uses these nations to judge his people Israel. There's another classic passage in, there's just so many of them. Isaiah 19. When God comes in judgment around 700 BC, God used the Assyrians to judge Egypt.
All right, we're going to have to go to a break right now, so you can pick up where you left off about the Assyrians, but also keep in mind that we have a number of people waiting to have their questions asked and answered as well, so you want to leave room for them as well. If anybody else wants to get in line and ask a question of your own, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com, and we will be back in about 12 minutes. This is our elongated break because of the requirements of Grace Life Radio, 90.1 FM in Lake City, Florida, who needs a 12-minute gap between the 2 hours. So why not take advantage of this time and write your questions for Brian Gadawa to Chris Arnson
at gmail.com, CHRISARNZEN at gmail.com. Don't go away. God willing, we'll be right back with Brian Gadawa after these messages from our sponsors.
Tired of box store Christianity, of doing church in a warehouse with all the trappings of a rock concert? Do you long for a more traditional and reverent style of worship? And how about the preaching? Perhaps you've begun to think that in-depth biblical exposition has vanished from Long Island. Well, there's good news. Wading River Baptist Church exists to provide believers with a meaningful and reverent worship experience featuring the systematic exposition of God's Word. And this loving congregation looks forward to meeting you. Call them at 631-929-3512 for service times. 631-929-3512. Or check out their website at wrbc.us. That's wrbc.us.
I'm James White of Alpha and Omega Ministries. The New American Standard Bible is perfect for daily reading or in-depth study. Used by pastors, scholars, and everyday readers, the NASB is widely embraced and trusted as a literal and readable Bible translation. The NASB offers clarity and readability while maintaining high accuracy to the original languages, which the NASB is known for. The NASB is available in many editions like a topical reference Bible. Researched and prepared by biblical scholars devoted to accuracy, the new topical reference Bible includes contemporary topics relevant to today's issues. From compact to giant print Bibles, find an NASB that fits your needs very affordably at nasbible.com. Whichever edition you choose, trust, discover, and enjoy the NASB for yourself today. Go to nasbible.com. That's nasbible.com.
Iron Sharpens Iron welcomes Solid Rock Remodeling to our family of sponsors. Serving South Central Pennsylvania, Solid Rock Remodeling is focused on discovering, understanding, and exceeding your expectations. They deliver personalized project solutions with exceptional results. Solid Rock Remodeling offers a full range of home renovations, including kitchen and bath remodeling, decks, porches, windows and doors, roof and siding, and more. For a clear, detailed professional estimate, call this trustworthy team of problem solvers who provide superior results that stand the test of time. Call Solid Rock Remodeling at 717-697-1981, 717-697-1981, or visit solidrockremodeling.com. That's solidrockremodeling.com. Solid Rock Remodeling, bringing new life to your home.
Are you a Christian looking to align your faith and finances? Then you'll want to check out Thrivent Financial. We're not your typical financial services provider. We're a not-for-profit Fortune 500 organization that helps our nearly 2.4 million members be wise with money. We provide guidance that reflects your values so you can protect what matters most. We help members live generously and strengthen the communities where they live, work, and worship. Learn more about the Thrivent story by contacting me, Mike Gallagher, financial consultant, at 717-254-6433. Again, 717-254-6433.
We know we were made for so much more than ordinary life.
Blending faith, finances, and generosity. That's the Thrivent story.
We were made to thrive.
Chef Exclusive Catering is in South Central Pennsylvania. Chef Exclusive's goal is to provide a dining experience that is sure to please any palate. Chef Damian White of Chef Exclusive is a graduate of the renowned Johnson & Wales University with a degree in culinary arts and applied science. Chef Exclusive Catering's event center is newly designed with elegance and style and is available for small office gatherings, bridal showers, engagement parties, and rehearsal dinners. Critics and guests alike acknowledge Chef Exclusive's commitment to exceeding even the highest expectations. I know of their quality firsthand since Chef Exclusive catered my most recent Iron Sharpens Iron Radio Pastor's Luncheon. For details, call 717-388-3000. That's 717-388-3000. Or visit chefexclusive.com.
That's chefexclusive.com.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org, that's ProvidenceBaptistChurchMA.org, or even on SermonAudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Iron Sharpens Iron Radio is sponsored by Harvey Cedars, a year-round Bible conference and retreat center nestled on the Jersey Shore. Harvey Cedars offers a wide range of accommodations to suit groups up to 400. For generations, Christians have enjoyed gathering and growing at Harvey Cedars. Each year, thousands of high school and college students come and learn more about God's Word. An additional 9,000 come annually to Harvey Cedars as families, couples, singles, men, women, pastors, seniors, and missionaries. 90 miles from New York City, 70 miles from Philly, and 95 miles from Wilmington, and easily accessible, scores of notable Christian groups frequently plan conferences at Harvey Cedars, like the Navigators, InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, Campus Crusade, and the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Find Harvey Cedars on Facebook or at hcbible.org, hcbible.org. Call 609-494-5689, 609-494-5689. Harvey Cedars, where Christ finds people and changes lives.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
And don't forget to order as many of the Solid Ground Christian Books titles as you can for all of the upcoming holidays and special days like Valentine's Day and Father's Day and all kinds of special days in the new year ahead. Of course, Mother's Day. There are many books for men, women, and children and all of the above, not only from great giants of theology from the past, but also even some very beloved and well-known and very biblical contemporary authors like Dr. James R. White of Alpha and Omega Ministries and others. That you can order from solid-ground-books.com, solid-ground-books.com, and even if you want to make that $50 mark from cvbbs.com, my other advertiser, in order to get the free $15 book by Dr. Joel Beakey on assurance, you can go to solid-ground-books.com, make a list of all of the Solid Ground Christian Books titles that you want to order, and then you could order them from cvbbs.com, killing two birds with one stone and helping both of our advertisers at the same time. Because cvbbs.com is not a publisher, they are a distributor, and Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher. So why not go to solid-ground-books.com today and make a long list of books that you want to order, and go to cvbbs.com to help make that $50 benchmark in order to get the free copy of Dr. Joel Beakey's book. And before I return to our guest today, Brian Gadawa, by the way, Brian, I forgot to mention to you that I forwarded Joe and Slovenia's email to you so you could have time to look over the second part of his question while I read a couple of announcements for special events that are coming up. So,
got it.
Okay, great. But coming up just in a couple of weeks, the G3 conference returns to Atlanta, Georgia. And I am so excited about returning to this conference. I had such a blast the last time I was there. Thousands of people will be at the G3 conference. And I'm so delighted I'll be manning an Iron Sharpens Iron exhibitors booth there. I met so many of you for the first time there last year. Not only people who have been sending in questions for my guests, but even people that I never even knew existed, who told me that they had been listening for years to the program. And also, I met a lot of you who were introduced to the program for the very first time. And I also had the privilege of interviewing a lot of guests that I previously only met by phone and interviewed by phone. And it was such a joy to interview face-to-face some guests that I have known going back to the 1990s, but I'd never met before in person, such as Phil Johnson of John MacArthur's Grace to You Ministries and others. But if you would like to register for this conference, it begins on the 17th of January. A Spanish-speaking edition of the conference will be available to those who speak Spanish in the daytime. Then on Wednesday night, the 17th of January, the English portion of the conference begins by being launched with a debate that Dr. James R. White of Alpha and Omega Ministries is having with a Muslim apologist. Then on Thursday, the 18th of January, the actual English-speaking conference begins with Stephen Lawson, Vody Balcom, Phil Johnson, Keith Getty, H.B. Charles Jr., Tim Challies, Josh Bice, James White, Tom Askell, Anthony Matheny, Michael Kruger, David Miller, Paul Tripp, Todd Friel, Derek Thomas, Martha Peace, Justin Peters, and Stephen Nichols. If you'd like to join me there, go to g3conference.com, g3conference.com. And by the way, the G3 stands for Grace, Gospel, and Glory, in case you're wondering. And the theme this January, or should I say this month, is Knowing God, a Biblical Understanding of Discipleship. And you can not only register to attend, but you could also, if you want to man your own exhibitor's booth for your church, your parachurch ministry, your business, you can register for your own exhibitor's booth, just as I am going to be doing there, God willing. So go to g3conference.com for both reasons. Please, please, please tell them that you heard about them from Chris Arnzen on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Now comes that part of the program that I hate doing, but it must be done. I have to beg you for money because we are in a very precarious situation financially in Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. We are truly on the brink of going off the air. Thanks to you and the listeners and the listening audience who have responded to my urgent call for help. We have bought some time and we are feeling a little bit safer here, but we are still in a perilous situation financially. Please, if you love this show, if you don't want it to go off the air, if you look forward to the topics and the guests every day, please go to ironsharpensironradio.com, click on support, and then mail us a check for any amount you can afford, made payable to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, to the address that you will see there when you click support. Never, ever, ever siphon money out of your regular giving to your local church. Never take food off of your family's dinner table or put your own family in financial jeopardy by giving to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Those two things are commands of God, providing for your home and providing for your church. And providing for my radio show is not a command of God, but if indeed you are able to obey those two commands and still you're financially capable of donating to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio, please consider doing that. We really appreciate all of you who have already done that and continue to do that. And if you want to advertise with us, just send me an email to chrisarnson@gmail.com and put advertising in the subject line. As long as whatever it is you're advertising is compatible with the theology we express on this program. Doesn't have to be identical. Just needs to be compatible. And also, obviously, there are many things that are theologically neutral, like grocery stores and shoe stores and all kinds of things that have no religious bearing upon them. You may feel free to launch any kind of an ad campaign like that. But please email us, and we really could use those advertising dollars. That email address, again, is chrisarnson@gmail.com. And that is also the email address to send a question to our guest, Brian Gadawa. That's chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnzen@gmail.com. Before we go to the second part of Joe and Slovenia's question, you were discussing right before the break the Assyrians, and if you could pick up where you left off.
Yeah, sure. Just really briefly, I was addressing probably the most difficult point for futurists to understand, that the second coming of Christ is not the same thing as the Christ's judgment coming in AD 70 on Israel. But nevertheless, Jesus came in judgment, but it wasn't, he didn't come literally or physically. He came spiritually in the armies of Rome. And, you know, Jesus said that, right? In Matthew 24, he said, you know, when you see the abomination of desolation, flee the city. What does that mean? Well, in Luke 21, Luke tells us what it means when he re-says the same sentence, but he explains it to his Greek listeners. He says, when you see the Roman armies surrounding Jerusalem, flee to the city. And so God uses the Roman armies to judge Israel, and he wants to get his Christians out of there. And so this notion of judgment coming, of Christ coming on the clouds, is so easily misunderstood because we impose on it our own vision of, oh, we see him literally surfing in on a cumulus nimbus. But all throughout the Old Testament, the Jews were very familiar with the fact that whether it's Isaiah 10, where God is judging Egypt, or Isaiah 19, or Ezekiel 30, where God is using Nebuchadnezzar to judge Egypt, or when he's using the Medes to destroy Babylon in Isaiah 13, he always says, I am coming on the clouds of judgment to judge that nation or that people. And so this is a phrase that actually meant that, did God literally come surfing in on cumulus nimbus? No. Whenever God judged a city, that's how he described it. So when we see that phraseology in the New Testament, when Jesus says that, it makes more sense. Oh, yes, of course. Jesus is going to judge by using the Roman armies to judge Israel for rejecting him as Messiah. Now, that means a lot of these passages have to be understood in their context, not our own. But that doesn't mean there aren't other passages that also speak of a return of Christ, a physical return of Christ. There are fewer of them than they think, but it's still there. And I would argue, you know, 1 Corinthians 15 talks about that. Traditionally, I think 1 Thessalonians 4 has been traditionally understood to be that, the second coming of Christ and the resurrection. So there are fewer passages that may indicate that, but that doesn't mean it's no longer existent. But I do think that when we start to re-understand these passages, like Matthew 24, which is the classic passage, you know, the end of the ages and the coming of the Son of Man, and you realize that he's actually talking about that judgment on Israel, it really starts to clarify, I think, the meaning of the New Covenant versus the Old Covenant, and how serious and yet how beautiful it is that God is replacing this old system with this whole new system, based on faith in the Messiah, right? And so that's the picture that many futurist Christians have a hard time dealing with, and I understand that. So one of the things that I do in my books, I write this novel series, Tyrant Rise of the Beast and Remnant Rescue the Wrecked. The first two books in the series are already done, but it's basically called Chronicles of the Apocalypse. What I do is, because I knew a lot of modern Christians might not be as educated on this understanding, the ancient Hebrew context of these phraseology, of this terminology. So what I did was, in the novels, I actually footnoted it, so that I knew that Christians would be reading this and they'd be going, oh, come on, really? They believed that back then? Yeah, they did. And so the way I wanted to prove it to them, to Christians, would be to footnote it And you can go back, and I have as many footnotes, I have as much text of footnotes in the novels as I have of the novel. And I did that because I knew a lot of Christians who understand or might appreciate a creative fictional story based on history would still have this desire to know the scriptural basis, and I wanted to provide that for them should they want to look it up. And that's what I did in all the novels. But I also wrote another book called End Times Bible Prophecy, where I explain all this in theological terms for those who want to go with just the theology. And I explain my own personal journey from, you know, dispensationalism into preterism. And I also go through Matthew 24 verse by verse, and I show how each verse was fulfilled in history in the past, so that Christians can see this isn't just fancy footwork. It's rooted in Old Testament language, and that's the beauty of it.
Okay, before we go to the second part of Joe and Slovenia's question, and we'll have to keep this brief, but I am also, at least at this point in my life, a partial preterist. I happen to be an amillennial partial preterist, unlike yourself, most likely. I know that most partial preterists are postmillennial. I happen to be an amillennial partial preterist. In fact, I learned much through the writings of John Bray before he became a hyper-preterist, which I believe was an unfortunate, very unfortunate development in his understanding of eschatology. But his earlier years, I gleaned much from him, and there was even a Church of Christ commentator on the Book of Revelation, Arthur Ogden, who is now with the Lord, that I learned much from his commentary on Revelation, the Avenging of the Apostles and Prophets. And, of course, Ken Gentry really convinced me that the Beast of Revelation was, in fact, Nero, yeah, in his book, The Beast of Revelation. But having said all that, I don't know if you would agree with me, but I wanted to have something clarified when you were talking about the last days in the scriptures referring to the last days of the economy of Judaism when the temple was destroyed. And by the way, I agree with you on the early writing of the New Testament, because of the fact that there is never a mention of the destruction of the temple other than Jesus' prophecy of it. And I would think that if the scriptures, the New Testament scriptures, were written after the destruction of the temple, it would have been mentioned somewhere. That's such a cataclysmic event in the history.
Yeah.
But I believe at one mention of the last days or last day that is referring to a future event is John chapter 6, verse 40, where we read, "For this is the will of my Father, that everyone who beholds the Son and believes in him will have eternal life, and I myself will raise him up on the last day." I believe that that is a reference to the future, sure, resurrection of the dead.
Sure, I can see that. I realize that there are different ways of interpreting that, even within the preterist camp. And so what you're indicating is there are some who will say, well, the last days began with the resurrection and ascension, but they go on into history until Christ returns. I recognize, in fact, I think Gentry even believes that. So I'm aware that that's definitely a possible way of interpreting it and scenario. I make sense of it as I gather all the verses. It does make sense to me that the context, you know, the consummation of the ages, the last days is when Messiah comes. But I acknowledge that, nevertheless, when he comes, things aren't completely finished. So that could justify believing that there might be, you know, last days that continue on. So I'm the camp that thinks the last days is basically about the last days of the old covenant. However, I can certainly see that using a phrase "last day" as a different sort of creative word. I can't think of the word. You know, we come up with these different phrases, and "last day" could be a specific reference to the resurrection at the end.
You're talking about allegorical, or is that what you mean?
No, I was thinking, like, you know how we come up with different phrases, like, you know, the end of the world, or, like, you
okay,
know, 9/11
right,
happened, uh-huh, it was the end of the world. We use those phrases to sort of, to depict different things at different times. So that's why I can see last days as being an actual technical term that they used a lot, but then the last day becomes a different term in reference to the resurrection itself.
Okay, let's try to get to some of our listener questions now. As I was saying, you should have in front of you Joe in Slovenia's question. The second part of his question is, for those of us raised on dispensationalism who are new to and relatively uninitiated in preterism, please explain specifically and clearly which of the apocalyptic prophecies of both the Old and New Testaments are still yet to be fulfilled, which prophetic fulfillments are still left behind and wait completion. Thank you very much for thoroughly addressing an interesting and challenging topic. And you really already addressed a lot of that. So
Yeah, I did. I would say, just as a brief recap, is that that which is yet to be fulfilled is Christ will be returning. There is a future final judgment and a future resurrection. But that's it, and there's not much more we know about that, because it's not tied to anything else like the tribulation and all that, because that stuff happened in the past.
We have Eddie and Hopog, who also just asked the same question. So, Eddie, if you want to send us another question that our guest has not addressed, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com, chrisarnson@gmail.com. Send us another question on a different topic if you'd like. But you and also Joe in Slovenia have both won a free copy of Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, compliments of our guest, Brian Gadawa, and they will be shipped to you, compliments of our friends at Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service, cvbbs.com, cvbbs.com, but no charge to you or to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. We have a listener who is also one of my favorite guests. She is a friend of mine. She is a brilliant woman and a published author herself. She's also not only a published author who has written on theological issues, she is a former Mormon who came to the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, the true Christ and the true gospel of the Holy Scriptures. Her name is Dr. Latane Scott, and I am going to be interviewing her very soon on her departure from Mormonism, because she has co-authored a new book that's in print, published by Kriegel, that is the testimonies of several Christians who have their doctorates who are former Mormons, and she is one of them. But Latane, let's see, her writing is, her font size is very small. So I apologize if I struggle with this a bit, because even with my glasses on, I'm having a difficult time with this. Let's see here. Latane says, what is the biggest challenge that you have as a novelist and filmmaker in trying to get unbelievers to read or view your work? What have you done to try to help with that situation?
Well, very good question. Number one is I seek to be true to myself, true to my own passions. And I what I mean by that is I don't try to write something that I think, oh, this will persuade them, or I'm going to try to convert people. I just want to write a story that I think is very entertaining, or that I think is very important or meaningful to me, because I believe that the stuff in which writers and storytellers are most passionate about is the material that tends to connect with people, even if they disagree with you. So, for instance, I've got a lot of people, I'm writing this series, you know, Chronicles of the Apocalypse, Partial Preterist, right? There's a lot of people who read my series who are futurists and don't agree with it. And they'll even say, I don't really agree with his interpretation, but he writes a great story and he tells a great story. And that's enough for me. Why? Because I believe that the power of storytelling is not in some, as you're reading it, you're going to get a rational, oh, I can see, and now I change my view. What you're going to do is, the power of storytelling is the ability to incarnate my message and my theme or my meaning into my characters, and the choices they make in life is how I communicate my worldview. And that's not always consciously noted or aware of it, but it will still affect people. And it takes time for things to get into your heart, get into your mind. And so what I do is I just write a good story, and I studied for many years on how to incarnate my meaning of my story or my theology or whatever you want to say, my worldview. I've studied how to embed or incarnate my worldview into those characters and choices that they make. And if anyone wants to read more about that, my book, Hollywood Worldviews, is still a good seller, and I explain a lot about how that works. And it clarifies for Christians, which will give them a better understanding of how storytelling really does affect us, even if we're not really aware of it. And that's because storytelling connects with our humanity in a deep way, in a different way than rationality. Now, listen, hear me clearly. I'm not saying either or here. It's both and. Of course we want to have rationality, but we are not just rational beings. We are also emotional and relational beings. And so storytelling connects with us on that relational side. And so that's how I incorporate my worldview. So, for example, my very first movie that got made was To End All Wars. That's about, you know, about 16 years old now, but it still is great. I highly recommend it. It still works. It's on Amazon Prime for anybody who wants to watch it, I think. But so what I did there was that was a true story of World War II POWs under the Japanese. And what it was is a true story based on how the Bible came into this prisoner of war camp and transformed the camp. That they began as, like, you know, Westerners who were focused on survival of the fittest, protecting themselves. But as they learned from the Bible, they actually became self-sacrificial with each other, and in the end, they also learned how to love their enemy, not just their neighbor, but their enemy, the Japanese. A very powerful spiritual story, and yet, it was basically a secular movie, but it had the Christian worldview embedded within it, and we had, you know, secular people loving the film and having no problem with some of the spiritual imagery in there because it was germane. It was embedded within the story, rather than how so many of these Christian storytellers and Christian filmmakers, they feel like they have to preach, like it has to be a sermon, and they don't understand how to tell stories in such a way that it grabs people's hearts. They feel that they have to explain everything very explicitly, like a sermon. Now, of course, there's a place for sermons, obviously, but art is not a sermon, and so that's how I play the difference where I don't try to preach explicitly. I just try to embed the worldview within the characters and the choices they make.
Well, thank you so much, Latane. And by the way, for those of our listeners who want to mark this down on their calendar, I will be interviewing Dr. Latane C. Scott and also Dr. Lynn K. Wilder on their book, Leaving Mormonism, published by Kriegel Publications. That interview will take place, God willing, a week from tomorrow, Thursday, January 11th, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And then the following day, two other contributors to that book will be on the program as well, giving their testimonies of Leaving Mormonism. And thank you very much, Dr. Latane C. Scott. You've also won a free copy of the book we are addressing today by Brian Gadawa, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast. So hope to hear from you soon with other great questions for our guests, and also look forward to many more interviews with you yourself. We're going to our final break right now. If you'd like to get in line and ask a question of our guest, our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. We will get to as many of you as time will allow. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Don't go away. God willing, we will be right back after these messages from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Pastor Bill Shishko, inviting you to tune in to A Visit to the Pastor's Study every Saturday from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern Time on WLIE Radio, www.wlie540am.com. We bring biblically faithful pastoral ministry to you, and we invite you to visit the pastor's study by calling in with your questions. Our time will be lively, useful, and I assure you, never dull. Join us this Saturday at 12 noon Eastern Time for a visit to the pastor's study, because everyone needs a pastor. ¶¶
Have you been blessed by Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? We remain on the air because of our faithful sponsors and because of listeners like you. There are four ways you can help. First, do you know potential sponsors who may wish to advertise their goods or services on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio? Second, whenever possible, purchase the products or use the services that our sponsors advertise. And then let them know that you heard about them on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio. Thirdly, you can also donate to Iron Sharpens Iron Radio by going to our website at ironsharpensironradio.com and click support at the top of the page. But most importantly, keep Iron Sharpens Iron Radio in your prayers. We hope that Iron Sharpens Iron Radio blesses you for many years to come.
Paul wrote to the church at Galatia, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." Hi, I'm Mark Lukens, pastor of Providence Baptist Church. We are a Reformed Baptist church, and we hold to the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. We are in Norfolk, Massachusetts. We strive to reflect Paul's mindset to be much more concerned with how God views what we say and what we do than how men view these things. That's not the best recipe for popularity, but since that wasn't the apostles' priority, it must not be ours either. We believe, by God's grace, that we are called to demonstrate love and compassion to our fellow man, and to be vessels of Christ's mercy to a lost and hurting community around us, and to build up the body of Christ in truth and love. If you live near Norfolk, Massachusetts, or plan to visit our area, please come and join us for worship and fellowship. You can call us at 508-528-5750, that's 508-528-5750, or go to our website to email us, listen to past sermons, worship songs, or watch our TV program entitled Resting in Grace. You can find us at providencebaptistchurchma.org, that's providencebaptistchurchma.org, or even on sermonaudio.com. Providence Baptist Church is delighted to sponsor Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Every day at thousands of community centers, high schools, middle schools, juvenile institutions, coffee shops, and local hangouts, Long Island Youth for Christ, staff and volunteers meet with young people who need Jesus. We are rural and urban, and we are always about the message of Jesus. Our mission is to have a noticeable spiritual impact on Long Island, New York, by engaging young people in the lifelong journey of following Christ. Long Island Youth for Christ has been a stalwart bedrock ministry since 1959. We have a world-class staff and a proven track record of bringing consistent love and encouragement to youths in need all over the country and around the world. Help honor our history by becoming a part of our future. Volunteer, donate, pray, or all of the above. For details, call Long Island Youth for Christ at 631-385-8333. That's 631-385-8333. Or visit liyfc.org. That's liyfc.org.
Charles Haddon Spurgeon once said,
"Give yourself unto reading. The man who never reads will never be read. He who never quotes will never be quoted. He who will not use the thoughts of other men's brains proves that he has no brains of his own. You need to read."
Solid Ground Christian Books is a publisher and book distributor who takes these words of the Prince of Preachers to heart. The mission of Solid Ground Christian Books is to bring back treasures of the past to minister to Christians in the present and future, and to publish new titles that address burning issues in the church and the world. Since its beginning in 2001, Solid Ground has been committed to publish God-centered, Christ-exalting books for all ages. We invite you to go treasure hunting at solid-ground-books.com. That's solid-ground-books.com and see what priceless literary gems from the past or present you can unearth from Solid Ground. Solid Ground Christian Books is honored to be a weekly sponsor of Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest for the last 90 minutes and the next 25 minutes or so to come is Brian Gadawa. We are discussing his book, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast. If you'd like to join us on the air, please do so immediately with an email at chrisarnson@gmail.com before we run out of time. chrisarnson@gmail.com. We'll get as many of you, we'll have as many of your questions asked and answered as we can while time permits. And we have Eddie from Hop Hog, Long Island, New York, who has submitted another question because the last one that he asked was already answered by you. He also is an amillennial partial preterist, just like me. And he says, do you place all of Revelation and Matthew 24 in the past? That's an interesting question because I know that our mutual friends Gary DeMar and Ken Gentry disagree on that, and they are both partial preterists and postmillennialists.
Yeah, I'm on Gary's side on that one. I definitely do think that all of Matthew 24 is the first century, and most all of Revelation is also the first century, except for Revelation 20. I want to point out that I have read Ken Gentry's new commentary on Revelation, which is not out yet. It will be out next year, but because I know him, he allowed me the privilege of being able to read the advanced copy of his commentary, and that's pretty much how he indicates it. Apart from things like, you know, obviously the kingdom of God will grow and fill the earth. That's obviously in the future, but I mean, in terms of what the basic prophecies are about in Revelation, it's pretty much all about that first century, but Revelation 20 is where it jumps into the future, and it hints at the second coming of Christ, and of course the final judgment and resurrection. I'm in that camp with Gary about Matthew 24. But interestingly, Gentry also is pretty much in that camp with Revelation. And I wanted to tell people that my series of Chronicles of the Apocalypse is actually, I'm utilizing Ken's Revelation commentary as my major source. I do, of course, refer to other sources, but his source in Revelation, he's sort of like my foundational scholar. So I like to think of my novel series as a kind of dramatic narrative of Gentry's eschatology. But I also incorporate stuff about the supernatural that Ken might feel a little bit more uncomfortable with because, for instance, I have things like angels and demons engaging in warfare and stuff, and that's not to say that he doesn't believe in that, but I definitely use some creative license in my novel series to say, oh, what would it look like, you know, that to show these angels and demons at war? And, you know, whenever you fictionalize, whenever you try to speculate about the spiritual world, you know, necessarily it's going to be guesswork, but I still try to be, like I say, as consistent as possible with what little we do know that's revealed in the book of Revelation.
Well, this might be an area, again, where you and I disagree. Do you believe that Revelation chapter 7, 9 is referring to something that's already fulfilled or something future, where we read, after these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes and palm branches were in their hands. Do you believe that that's something that's already fulfilled, or do you think that's a future reference to heaven and the elect that have been saved from every tribe and tongue and people and nation?
Well, this would be a case where I would argue that that's something that occurs in the first century, but of course goes on into history. And the reason why I say that is, if you read further on down, John says to the angel, "Sir," he says, "who are these clothed in white?" And he says to me, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." So I think that that's basically rooted in the first century, because John, in Revelation 1, verse 7, said, "I, John, your partner in the tribulation." So he thought that the tribulation was going on in his time period as he was writing Revelation, and that great tribulation, I believe, is rooted in the Neronic persecution, you know, where Nero threw the Christians to the lions and blamed the great fire of Rome on the Christians, and so it starts out there. But of course, if it, you know, a multitude without number means that there's all, you know, so many you can't count. And of course, I believe that that's going to grow throughout history. So that might be an example where it begins in the first century, but it goes on into history. But I wanted to make this other point that one of the, you know, in my series, like in the first book, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, what I wanted to do was I wanted to show why I thought Nero, as you mentioned this earlier, Nero was the beast of Revelation. And so I actually pull out a lot of historical facts about Nero. I tell a bit of his story. I tell what he did to Christians. And I'm drawing from a lot of historical sources, as well as some Christian legends, you know, because we don't know all the facts, and sometimes they make legends, but you're not sure. But I draw from all these different sources to try to recreate that, what happened under Nero, what it was like to be a Christian in Rome, as well as in Asia Minor, as well as in Jerusalem, and how they were persecuted. And so sometimes I want to warn people that it gets a little brutal at times, because if you read the historical facts, you'll find that Nero did just brutal, barbaric things. Like, for instance, he didn't just throw them to the lions. He also would hang Christians on poles, cover them with pitch, and light them on fire as like candles in the night. And he did lots of stuff like this, and I bring that stuff to light because I want to show people how truly horrible it was and why I believe that was the great tribulation that the Bible talks about and that Jesus himself prophesied, you know? And so that's where Tyrant, Rise of the Beast begins. But then I take the protagonists of the story are actually a Christian, a Jew, and a Roman. And the Roman is sort of this warrior guy, and he has the Jewish doctor with him, and a Christian is one of their servants. And the Roman gets, this is the fictional part. I'm telling a fictional story in the context of a historical reality. So I have the Roman is tasked by Nero. Nero hears that there's this secret, subversive letter that's being passed around the empire, right? That's talking about the end of the world and the assassination of him. So he goes, I want you to find out where it is, who wrote it, and kill him if you can. And so that's kind of the storyline of my book is kind of like a Da Vinci Code with supernatural elements in it, you know. And as our heroes try to track down the letter, they ultimately find out it's the letter of Revelation, and they find out it's written by John. They go to the island of Patmos. And so it's this journey that ultimately leads them to Jerusalem, where they then have to try to help the Christians to get out of the city because of the prophecies. Jesus said that Rome is coming to destroy it, and this letter from Revelation, John is confirming that they're coming, so you got to get out so the Christians won't be judged along with the rest of the Jews in the city, right? But the problem is the Christians are having a hard time believing that the letter is from John, and that's where my book Remnant takes up the story. And so I'm trying to tell this picture so we journey through Rome, Asia Minor, and end up in Jerusalem, and we get exposed to all these historical things that are going on. And that's why I try to depict what the Great Tribulation may have looked like back then, how those people in that time may have seen Nero as the beast. In fact, there's a lot of historical references, I have several of them in my footnotes, where they refer to Nero as a beast. So this wasn't a unique term. You know, right. if you look back at Daniel used the term beast for any godless ruler or empire that was against God.
And
it's a very common word.
And I recall from Ken Gentry's book, The Beast of Revelation, that Nero wore the skins of animals and he would walk on all fours up to Christians tied to stakes and gnaw off with his teeth parts of their body, cannibalizing.
You're absolutely right, and I have that in my novel. I absolutely have that as well. So
time for the holidays, folks.
Yeah, yeah. Beware, this is not for the squeamish, but I try to be, you know, I try to be, how should I say, I don't try to be gross and too explicit, but I definitely try to deal with the real sin and evil that was going on in that time period. So, but it's definitely not for the squeamish of heart.
And
by the way,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, go ahead.
I wanted to make the point that in all this talk, you know, like we've mentioned Amil, Postmil. I try, you know, look, I have a definite viewpoint that I think it is, and I've got to tell a story, so I have to choose a pathway. But even in my books and novels, I try to bring other viewpoints in as much as possible to sort of show the fact that there are different ways of seeing things. And so my goal, my hope, is that futurists can read the novels and still appreciate the entertainment and maybe learn a thing or two from a view they disagree with. But also, you know, amillennialists who might tend to believe that a lot of the imagery is more about general, allegory or images about history in general that are repetitive through history, they'll still be able to look at this and say, oh, yeah, I can see he makes that connection, and I can see that as well, but I happen to believe it also is related to other, points in history as well. So my goal is to try to, you know, make have something in there that everyone can draw from and appreciate.
Yes, and I'm imagining if this is about the days of Nero, that the other future differences between the eschatological positions wouldn't even be come into bear. But I might be wrong about that. I haven't read your novel yet.
Well, you know how a lot of different viewpoints will often agree that the first few chapters of Revelation, where he's writing to the seven churches, right, in Asia Minor, a lot of people agree that that part, whatever you agree about the rest, think about the rest of Revelation, many scholars really do believe that that is about that first century, and he was writing to real churches of that time period. At least I think most people do. Now, some people believe that's also symbolic of the church at different times in history, yes. But I think most people can also see the historical reference in there. So I actually have Satan as well going to each of those churches in Asia Minor and confronting, trying to deceive and draw down the people in each of those cities while the angels are trying to sort of protect them at the same time. So, you know, I bring a little bit of that in there as well.
And then there are people that believe in double fulfillment, that, yes,
yeah,
Nero may have been a beast of Revelation, but there is another beast waiting to come and all that.
And that shouldn't be a problem for those people.
Right. We have Susan Margaret in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, who has a question that may shock and sound very bizarre to many of our listeners. But Susan Margaret in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania says, correct me if I'm wrong, but I have heard that Nero was involved in one of the first sex change operations that has ever been recorded in history. And that may
yes,
he was. I heard that from Ken Gentry also.
Yes, and I have that in my novel because I think that it's very interesting that a lot of the stuff that we are experiencing in our society, as bad as it is, it was way worse in Rome, and man has always, history is cyclical, and what goes around comes around, but I also think we can learn a lot if we see what things led to the fall of Rome, and that was one of them. We can maybe learn lessons from history. But I have Nero, he actually married two different guys. One guy he married, his name was Sporus, and he was a servant who reminded him of his previous wife, Poppaea, the empress. And interestingly, Nero kicked Poppaea to death because he had these temper tantrums, but he still loved her. He had this weird, twisted love for her, right? So Sporus kind of looked like her, so he castrated him and made him look like Poppaea and married him. And then he also had another guy who was, I forgot his name off the top of my head, but he was more of a masculine guy, and so he married him as well. But interestingly, that was frowned upon by a lot of the people in royalty because they felt that even though they believed in having all kinds of weird, sexual things, they thought that the emperor should not do so because you got to remember, Rome, ancient imperial Rome, was founded on pater familias, the father as the household, father as the representative of the household. So it was very important for them to have Caesar be rooted in that traditional pater familias. He could do whatever he wants secretly, but they felt it was wrong for him to do it publicly. But he didn't care, so he did it publicly.
Yes, and of course, we as Christians, and of course every scientist will also tell you, if they're being honest, that you cannot really change someone's sex, but I understand.
Right.
Of course, the back then they could only do what they could do. They didn't have the hormone treatments or anything like that.
Yeah.
But we have. Oh, by the way, Susan Margaret, you've also won a free copy of the book *Tyrant: Rise of the Beast*. Thank you very much for your excellent question. And we have Arnie in Perry County, Pennsylvania, who says, Have you been able to share the gospel with some of these celebrities that God has providentially brought into your path, like Kiefer Sutherland and others?
Well, that's a good question. I am, as a writer, they have to understand writers are low on the totem pole in Hollywood. So we don't, in general, meet with stars or celebrities or whatever. We pretty much only work with our producers, and we spend most of our time alone in our room, sitting on our butts, writing in our computers. So we're not the ones hobnobbing around with celebrities and stuff, you know. So I share the gospel with people that I come into contact with. But as a matter of fact, we have some of this on the behind-the-scenes footage on the Two End Wars DVD. But it was very interesting because when they were shooting the Two End Wars movie, I did go on the set to watch for a couple weeks, and I didn't get to interact with the stars, but I interacted with a lot of the people on the staff, you know, and the, you know, they're standing around doing the background work, you know, stuff like that, like electricity or extras, stuff like that. So I actually shared the gospel with them because they would say, well, what's this movie about? And then I would tell them what the movie was about, and I know how to, you know, share the gospel while I'm telling the story. But I did hear stories about how powerful of an impact some of the Christians had on the stars because it was being shot in Hawaii, and the director, his dad was the head of Youth with a Mission. Youth with a Mission. And so he had kids from the Youth with a Mission serve as, you know, helpers on the set. And they were servants. They were servants, man. They had servants' hearts, and the cast and the crew were impressed by them, found out they were Christians. But there was one time when Kiefer Sutherland, I heard the story that, you know, he heard some people talking about Christianity and faith, and he said, you know, the only guy I'm never going to listen to this if he has anything to say about religion or spirituality is my co-star. I can't remember. One of the minor stars was on set with him in some of the scenes, and he got to like this guy, and it so happens that this guy was a Christian. So he said, the only one I'm going to listen to if they talk about Christianity is going to be this guy, and that guy happened to be a Christian. And from what I understand, he did share to his own, you know, whatever limited extent he could with the time he had. So I think that there was a mindfulness on set of everyone involved about living our faith, but also when the opportunity came. And so there was some of those that happened, but I wasn't personally involved with any of the celebrities.
We have Joey in Clifton, New Jersey. Thanks for sharing a lot of interesting facts today. I am also a partial preterist. I mean this question respectfully as a sincere attempt to understand. If you are mixing fiction with both historical fact and scriptural truth, how do you think people can sort out the distinctions? I am curious as to what feedback you have from people like Damar Gentry and others. More importantly, I am interested in your view of how we help people actually learn and retain what is true. Well, I guess, Joey, you missed in the very beginning. I read a commendation, a very powerful commendation that Gary Damar wrote for this book, Tyrant. But if you could answer the other parts of that question.
Sure. Sure. And if you go to the Amazon website, I also have a quote from Ken Gentry as well, an endorsement from Ken as well. I've got both of their endorsements, as well as another guy in that camp, Andrew Sandlin. So,
oh, yeah. I know Andrew Sandlin.
Yeah, I have several of them. So, what was the question?
Well, let me read it again. Let's see. if you are mixing fiction with both historical fact and scriptural truth, how do you think people can sort out the distinctions?
Yes. Well, first of all, you sort out by having to realize that all of history is written from singular perspectives, and people add their own fictions anyway. So even though, you know, I believe we can know what happened, you know, you have to understand that history is mixed with all kinds of bias. And so there's no, you know, there's nothing that's not going to have fiction in it anyway. But also, I footnote the novel so that if you're reading, you say, did this really happen? You can go and check it out. And I tell you where I make significant changes for creative purposes. And I'll explain, well, here's what really happened. But the reason why I did it this way, because it fits better with the story at this point, but it doesn't change the theology or it doesn't change the history. So, for instance, there are things like, you know, Maybe there were five guys in an event and I only have one guy or two guys because I have to simplify. Or maybe the event took a week, but I have it happen in one day. You know, there's things like that that you do that doesn't really affect the meaning of it, but it just makes the story move quicker. But for those who wanted that accuracy, I did give the footnotes. And secondly, it's the nature of fiction writing is this. You want to have your main characters be fictional characters so that you can tell the story the way that you need to with entertainment purposes, but you place them in a historically true scenario. So, I also have Nero in there and such like that. But what I'm saying is my main characters are fictional, but everyone else is historical, and that allows me to tell my story through my fictional characters, but they interact with the real historical characters. And, that's one of the classic ways in storytelling that you are able to mix the two. And people just have to trust that, you're getting as close as you can to history. You're not claiming it to be scripture, but you're just trying to make the point and tell the story as accurately as you can. But, you have to remember, history itself is also imbued with a lot of fiction because people try to remember what happened, and they're not always accurate either. In fact, my main source of history for the entire series is Josephus' Wars of the Jews. Now, he was a Jew who actually went through the event, but if you study Josephus, as many scholars have, you will discover that he was very biased, and he had a specific agenda, and he had a twofold agenda. One is he wanted to kiss up to the Roman people because they saved him. He was actually in the Jewish war on the Jewish side. He got captured, and then he decided to try to help the Romans in a way that he could try to convince the Jews to surrender so that they wouldn't get wiped out. But they didn't listen to him, right? So he's in between these two worlds, and you see his two agendas coming out as he's writing. That doesn't mean he's lying. It just means that he has a bias, and you have to realize that everyone has a bias, and so therefore everyone has a spin on things. My goal is to be as true to the spirit of what I thought really happened as possible, and then to give my, give my footnotes and biblical proofs why I believe it fulfills the prophecies.
Well, Joey, you've also won a free copy of the book, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, as has everyone who is still waiting on hold, if you will, to have their questions asked, but we don't have time for that. If you could, in about 2 minutes' time, no more, summarize what you most want etched in the hearts and minds of our listeners today, Brian.
Well, I guess what I want them to do is to realize that the power of the Bible is not just our rational, doctrinal truths and propositional truths. Yes, it's partly that, but there's also an imaginative side in Scripture. God uses a lot of poetry. He uses a lot of figurative descriptions to describe spiritual realities that we can't see. And so the more that we study and understand their context, their ancient context, and what their language meant to them, not to us, I believe the closer we'll get to understanding the intent of the Scriptures. And oftentimes it's not the same as the way modern Christians often interpret it. So I think that the more you pursue that ancient Hebrew context and ancient Near Eastern context, you'll understand the Scriptures better. And that if you want to learn a little bit more about this, if you're curious about me, but you don't want to just, I don't want to just go to Amazon and buy this stuff. All my stuff's at Amazon. I have audiobooks, Kindle, and paperback, so you can get any version you want. But if you want to learn a little bit more about me before you go any further, Godawa.com, my website, has everything. That's Godawa.com. I have free scholarly articles. I explain things. I tell the summary of the story so you can learn about it. See a bunch of artwork and stuff, and maybe it'll help you get a better handle if you're curious, but you're not sure if you want to jump in or not.
And just out of curiosity, what nationality is Godawa? Interesting name.
It's Polish.
Oh, I'm half Polish. My mother's
Godawa.
Side. Yeah, my mother's side of the family were my maternal grandparents were both from Poland, and the name was Husak, Husak. But thank you so much for being on the program, Brian, and I look forward to your return to the program. And I want to thank everybody who wrote in today. I want to thank everybody who also listened to the program, and I want you all to always remember for the rest of your lives that Jesus Christ is a far greater Savior than you are a sinner. And by the way, tomorrow we have another partial preterist postmillennialist on the program. We have Jeff Durbin on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio tomorrow, and he's going to be giving us a blueprint for abortion mill evangelism. So mark your calendars for tomorrow, 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, for Jeff Durbin and his blueprint for abortion mill evangelism. God bless you all. We look forward to hearing from you and your questions for Jeff Durbin tomorrow on Iron Sharpens Iron Radio.